I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back.
We're here with Paul Greenberg. His book is For Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. And what inspired me about this was not the book at first, but the book has since I've read it, was an article I read that you wrote in the New York Times Magazine about tuna. And so I had just come back from a trip with my wife, and we came back, and that night we were very hungry.
And
so we went to, it was a Friday night.
Therein all problems start.
That's where it began. And we went to this sushi restaurant. It was a seafood restaurant, and they had this tuna steak.
Yeah.
Which was really to die for, the way they make it.
I'm sure.
And so I said, I really could use that light, beautiful tasting tuna. I ordered it.
Yeah.
And it was just exquisite. And I went, oh, God, hey, this is really good fish. And so we go home, and we chill out. We do our work around the weekend. And Sunday morning comes, the Times is outside. I walk down the driveway, pick it up. Started reading the Times, pull out the magazine section, and there was your article on
tuna's end.
Tuna's end.
Burp.
So I read the article and went, oh, man.
Yeah.
I said, I can't eat tuna anymore. And I haven't had a bite of tuna since, and it's your fault now.
Well, yes. You know, to qualify a bit, I mean, the tuna use probably were presented with at the restaurant was probably yellowfin tuna. And they are not as in dire straits as the Atlantic bluefin, which was really what I was focusing on.
Right.
But that said, you know, across the board, even the more sort of conservative fisheries biologists who have been looking at the tuna problem say that globally – tuna populations are down by about 25% across species. And there are about three dozen species of tuna out there. So, you know, with Atlantic bluefin, however, if that was an Atlantic bluefin steak that was in front of you, then you were very well. You'd best avoid them in the future because, I mean, those fish are down 95% in the Western stock and about 80% in the Eastern stock. So they're really seriously depleted at this point. And, you know, I don't think people should be eating them right now.
But what it did was I brought that article in to my producers that Monday morning and said, I really want to talk to this guy about this article. And they said, well, wait a minute, there's a book coming out, Four Fishes.
Excellent. That's the way it works, man. We plant it in the media ahead of time. It flows downstream. And we talk about the book. Here I am.
So I said, okay, let's wait for the book.
Yeah. Great. Well, that's great.
So this, so your four fishes we're talking about in this book, and let's to tell our listener what you've done here.
Yep.
The Future of the Last Wild Food is what the subtitle of the book is, and we're talking about salmon, sea bass, cod, and tuna.
Yes.
But you, as you write in the article, and also talk about throughout the book, and at the end of the book when you went on this fishing trip after with your daughter Tanya.
Yep.
That you have a passion for fishing.
I do, indeed.
Since you were a child.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have even gotten anywhere near writing a book about fish if I just didn't love fishing. And I started fishing probably from the age of three, although I got real serious about it. After my parents divorced, we lived in rural Connecticut, or well, sort of rural Connecticut, in the backwoods of Greenwich. We rented. We did not own. I always like to qualify that.
A working-class Jewish boy, an odd thing.
That's right. Exactly. Well, or sort of, you know, I would say, you know, rootless Jewish boy. Working class, I don't know. My mother barely worked, but she we didn't have any money either. So anyway, no, it's not true. She worked very hard. But she would move us around to different estates in the backwoods of Greenwich, and these estates often would have these sort of abandoned ponds.
Right.
And the pond that sort of shows up at the beginning of the book is sort of the fishing spot for me. And I remember we moved in, and I remember coming down to the side of the lake and being a little depressed because we just moved again, and we were constantly moving, and just seeing the woods open up and this sort of Eden-like environment open up, and in the very surface of the water you could see these 2 and 3 foot long largemouth bass just basking in the sun. And it was like, and nobody was around. It was like, this is, and it's like, these are all mine. I didn't catch them. But it actually took a while to actually catch them because I, you know, was a very unschooled fisherman. The early days of the attempts, my friend and mine, we took, remember that there was that dog food called Gaines Burgers?
Yeah,
it was
sure.
Like these little burgers that,
these
you know.
Fake burgers. Burgers for your dog, yeah.
So the first attempt at trying to catch these fish, we took actually safety pins and tied purple yarn onto them and put a piece of Gainsburger on and threw them out. But then a herd of sort of elite German, golden retrievers came in and ate all the Gainsburgers, and that was that. But then we finally figured out that a single kernel of corn on a small hook thrown in, right in front of these bass, that was what would hook them. And we caught them all year one year, but then they all disappeared after we had a big fish kill in the wintertime. A big storm came, and that was the end of them.
Now you begin this saga, and it's a really fascinating saga that you tell. And I love the people that you've met.
Mm-hmm.
And you start with salmon.
Yeah. Well, I started with salmon. Actually, in the original structure of the book, salmon came a little bit later. But then I realized that, above all, I wanted this book to reach people who ate a lot of fish. And what do people eat a lot of? It's salmon. Everybody eats salmon. Right. I mean, and I actually talked to one supermarket chain guy, and he said to me, you know what, I wouldn't even have a seafood section if it weren't for salmon.
I read that, right?
And the thing is with salmon is, you know, what's very interesting about salmon is it represents really the key issues of what's going on with fish and the key issues that are in the book, which is that, you know, up until late 1960s, all the salmon that we ate was wild. You remember growing up having Nova lox, right? You know,
right.
And lox, by the way, comes from the Indo-European word lox, which means salmon.
Oh, by the way, a little digression,
yes,
about
please.
Your book,
yeah.
And then we'll come right back to
yeah,
the
sure,
lox,
sure, sure.
Which I also love about the book, and I think people who haven't read it will really get into it.
Thank you.
Is your passion as like an amateur linguist of getting into
yeah.
the words and where they come from. I
yeah.
think that's a...
Yeah, and I think, you know, well, yeah, there's a long digression about where does the word bass come from? So many
right.
fish are called bass. And that's when I realized that there is this kind of dissociation that goes on between consumers and the wild ocean, and that dissociation actually begins with names, where we
right.
have these sort of broad categories, bass, tuna, and we just sort of think, well, that's just a single species, but actually they represent many species, and they've come to actually represent a dynamic in the marketplace of one kind of fish being substituted in for another when the original fish, you know, goes bust in the wild. So that's why I went into linguistics.
So we'll come to that.
Yeah,
yes,
we'll come back. But anyway, back to salmon. Yeah, so yeah, all salmon that we ate was wild until the late 60s. And two phenomena happened. The first was that in the late 40s, early 50s, a small group of Danish and Faroese fishermen, they found a little patch of water off of Greenland where every single Atlantic salmon in the world went to feed. You know, salmon, they, you know, as people know, they spawn in rivers and they hatch and they come down the rivers and then they shoot out to sea and, you know, travel several thousand miles. And they were all over the northern hemisphere. They came to this one spot in Greenland. So, but when the Danish and Faroese found them, they fished them really hard. And you see Atlantic salmon, and this, we're talking about the species Atlantic salmon, go into steep, steep, steep decline throughout the 50s and 60s.
Was the salmon we ate most as children.
Yeah. I mean, if you were having smoked or fresh salmon, it was Atlantic salmon most of the time.
And because canned was from the West.
Canned was from the West, generally.
Right.
Yeah, because,
right.
you know, so yeah, we'll get to that in a sec. But all the salmon, any wild salmon we eat today is Pacific salmon. And that there's all these canneries set up to do that. But anyway, getting back to Atlantic salmon, so those fish go into tremendous decline. A lot of people think that, you know, salmon were wiped out primarily by dams and pollution and so forth. And they did play a very significant role. But the whole overfishing thing is actually totally missed a lot of times. And that moment when those fish were discovered and fished hard was kind of the death knell for Atlantic salmon. And now Atlantic salmon are, you know, what we call in fisheries terms, they're commercially extinct, which means they're, you know, it is not worth it financially to go fishing for wild Atlantic salmon. So anytime you see in the marketplace, Scottish salmon, Irish salmon, Norwegian salmon, Nova Scotia, Nova lox, all farmed, all of it. So, and the reason is because the parallel phenomenon is that as Atlantic salmon go into steep decline, a guy named Trygve Gjedrem from Norway comes to America, starts studying quantitative genetics.
Who you met?
I met Trygve, yeah. Right. And he studied quantitative genetics in the 50s with 50s or early 60s with a very famous animal breeder in America named Jay Lush. And he learned the techniques of basically figuring out how to do selective breeding on salmon. And so what they did then was they collected from 40 river systems in Norway, they collected all these different types of varieties of the same species Atlantic salmon, and they interbred them, and they bred them again and again and again. And within 15 or so years, they were able to double the growth rate of Atlantic salmon in the farm. So you have these kind of two parallel situations. You have the decline of wild salmon with all its weird complicated diversity. And then the rise of what, you know, Atlantic salmon in Latin is called Salmo salar. But people have started to call this new breed of salmon that the Norwegians started to breed, they call it Salmo domesticus.
Right.
And it's in effect, it's not a separate species, but it's different.
Well, I think
what's
important about this, I want to explore just for a minute and come
yeah,
back
sure.
to the salmon and the other
yep.
fish, is that, and I think about this issue of what to eat and fish a
yep.
great deal.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you don't do here, you clearly have issues we'll talk about later with
yeah.
fish farming and where you think we need to go and
yep.
sustainability and what we need to think about.
Yep.
But you don't demonize the fish farmers.
No.
Nor glorify the wild fish.
Right.
I think this is a really important balance you're trying to achieve in your way of looking at this.
Absolutely. And, you know, I have to say, like, just a background for me is that I used to train journalists in Russia right after the fall of the Soviet Union. And I was very used to journalists coming to me with the sort of Soviet approach to journalism where you have a thesis and then you backfill in whatever facts you can find to prove your thesis.
Right.
And we were always kind of working against that. And I guess that was sort of going into this as a journalist, I felt like I didn't want to demonize fish farmers. I didn't want to demonize fishermen. I just wanted to hear what the story was and to try and kind of, to best my knowledge, you know, and abilities, you know, present it on an even playing field. Yeah. So, I mean, let's look at the wild salmon situation, for example. So all of our wild salmon today pretty much comes from Alaska. But what a lot of people don't realize, you know, there's a lot of people, I often ask people when I do readings, you know, who out there categorically refuses to eat farmed fish? You know,
I would raise my hand. If
right,
I
probably
would
raise your hand.
Right.
Well, meanwhile, 30 to 40% of Alaska salmon begin their lives in a hatchery. And, you know, this is a practice. It's called stock supplementation, and it's been going on for years. And the idea is that, you know, don't have enough fish in the ocean to catch later on. Well, let's just put some more little fish in the rivers, and we'll kind of, you know, put these rivers on high octane, and we'll get more salmon back. And they do get more salmon back, but in the process of doing it, you're actually altering the genetics of the salmon runs that, you know, when you put little fish that you've raised in a hatchery into a stream, you're bypassing a very important natural selection process. The most important natural selection that goes on with fish is the transition from egg to larvae to eventually to small fish. You know, most of the fish that die in that transition. So if you're taking fish, you're taking eggs, you're putting them in a hatchery, you're raising them to what's called smolt size, and then you're putting them out in the river, what you've done is you've cut away the necessity to select viable creatures that can go from egg to smolt. And so what we could be doing is overpopulating Alaskan rivers with basically unviable fish. In other words, those fish might not have the genetics to go out to sea, come back, spawn, and lay eggs that will then in turn become viable adults. And you're kind of cutting the run of salmon off at the ankles. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's funny, fish farmers can't stand the way that Alaska promotes itself as this wild fish haven. And in fact, a lot of people call it a ranching project. And what's interesting, actually, is that Japan actually gets all of their salmon from this kind of process. They actually have canneries where they release eggs from the cannery or smolts from the canneries. They swim out to sea and they swim right back to the cannery. And what's interesting is that when they do tabulations of the wild salmon left in the world, they count this Japanese salmon as wild. So is that wild or farmed?
Or is it, right. It's very difficult. I mean, when you talk about salmon, as you talk about tuna.
Yeah.
They're very muscular, powerful fish.
Yep.
Because of the process of
migrating and, you know, they have to swim against, you know, 10, 50 knot currents. They're heavily, heavily carnivorous, you know, which is one of the reasons why people have objected to them as farmed fish. You know, they are there are many, many farmed fish out there and possible candidates for farming that are either omnivorous or vegetarian in their diets. Tilapia, for example,
which you talk about at the end of the book,
which I talk about, and catfish, not so much in the book, but American farm-raised catfish are actually a very positive thing for the environment. They, you know, American farm-raised catfish came onto the market because farmers in the South lost their grain market during the Soviet embargo of the early 70s, so they needed another product. So what they did is started flooding their cornfields and raising catfish. And what they did was they created wetlands. So, you know, the farming of catfish was actually a net benefit for the environment.
Right.
Anyway, But with salmon, so, you know, it's not an ideal fish for aquaculture. We farmed it probably most of all because it was valuable. You know, when salmon farming started, there weren't enough wild salmon and the market prices were very, very high. But what that did, though, is to drive the price of both wild and farm salmon down. When they finally figured it out, they started producing it in huge numbers. And so the price of salmon overall is really, in my opinion, far below the ecological cost of both salmon farming and salmon fishing. And I think it's made this, you know, fish that was never that common. I mean, there are a lot of salmon out there in the Pacific. There were a lot of salmon in the Atlantic. But comparative to the other fish in the sea, like, say, you know, codfish, for example, salmon was always something of a specialty. And to turn it into this kind of everyday fish, that as we have done as a result of farming, I think was kind of an ecological mistake.
Well, I want to hit the other fish, but let me just ask you this question as we gear ourselves into the cod and the bass and some tuna.
Yeah. Why not?
And your ideas about where to go.
Yep.
But, I mean, you talk about salmon as a fish starting at the fishery starting in Norway, the first really farmed fish.
Yep.
And that's been going on for a long time. And it is now – there's almost no turning back.
There is.
Raising them in Chile, as you point out.
Yep.
And the other places where – in the United States and Norway. And, and so they're here. But they're also getting out.
Yes. And they're escaping great numbers in the millions per year. They escape, but I think more important than maybe the escape issue is the disease transfer issue. You know, you farm salmon where salmon like to be. So inevitably, salmon farms are being sited where wild salmon migrations are. So you have issues of like sea lice, which is an external parasite that can be quite dangerous for wild fish. There's a disease called infectious salmon anemia that can jump from the farm to the wild population. So, yeah, there's significant problems with it. But as you point out, you know, there is a market for salmon right now. So I think what we need to do is to try and figure out, is there a salmon-like fish out there that doesn't have the ecological cost of salmon? And actually, there is.
And it is?
It's not in the book, but it's Arctic char. Has been coming Arctic char. It's been coming to my attention a lot lately. So Arctic char is interesting.
It looks like salmon when you buy it.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. It looks like the flesh looks the same. And in profile, if you were to do a profile of a char and a salmon, you know, just black and white, you wouldn't be hard to tell the difference unless you were
a North Atlantic fish originally, right?
So Arctic char, they have both a landlocked and an anadromous, you know, a sea-run variety. But they're very, very far in the north. And this is the key. Arctic char live in lakes that often can freeze almost solid. And what happens is they get crowded together really tightly. And what that resembles most of all, of course, is an aquaculture facility. Turns out that Arctic char can be farmed in these closed recirculating facilities in pretty high densities. And they're more omnivorous than salmon. They can eat more vegetarian feed. And so they have much lower ecological cost. And I just did a whole West Coast sweep, and we've been trying it out at different restaurants. We had it smoked, lightly smoked in a salad, delicious. Had it as sushi, delicious. And, you know, it's not that much more expensive than salmon. You know, if you're already going to kind of get to the point where you're going to choose salmon, say, over chicken, you know, I think you could probably choose the char. And nearly all char is now grown in these recirculating facilities. So
I get so insane about what I will and won't eat.
Yeah.
In Baltimore, there are two men who actually are Alaskan fishermen.
Oh, yeah.
And what they do is they – one guy I buy from, he doesn't sell to the canneries.
Yeah, yep.
He fillets on the spot. Vacuum packs them and freeze dries them right away.
Yep.
Ships them back, so you end up buying this frozen fresh salmon.
Yep.
That you eat during the course of the year, but it's expensive.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
But it lasts you a while, and
what do they charge a pound for it?
Which is pretty cheap, $12-$14 a pound.
Not too bad, considering you know the miles involved. And is it sockeye or do you know?
It's all four varieties, and
they
do what he can get.
Nice, nice.
Net fishes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I've actually fished with guys like who do that. And there's a number of these little co-ops appearing because actually, you know, it's amazing what the canneries have done to these local fishermen. You know, a lot of them end up in debt to the canneries. So, you know, the canneries are for years, the only business in town that would actually offer a loan. And so what happens is the fishermen, you know, get into deeper debt. They have to sell more fish to the cannery, and it's just this kind of vicious cycle. So to get out of that cycle, people, as you're talking about, have started these little co-ops where they, you know, fresh freeze things. They treat the fish better, actually. They bleed them after they catch them, which allows that
right.
gives them a longer shelf life. They don't let them sit in the front of the boat and bake in the hot sun. There is hot sun in Alaska, believe it or not.
There is.
But yeah, so that's a positive trend, I think. Yeah.
So you took this excursion for this book, and it really took you across the globe.
It did indeed. Yeah.
I didn't get a chance to talk about some of the interesting folks you met up and when you did your sound work at Jack Kidwell and the Yupik Indian leader that you flew around with, and the story where he traded his salmon for that chicken.
Yes. Yeah, at one point, we ran into an oil tanker and we swapped a king salmon for some chicken parts, you know, wrapped in plastic and foam. That to me actually was a very important moment.
It was a lesson for you.
Yeah, though. I mean, that's actually, you know, when you start a book, you never know what's going to actually be the sort of backbone of it. But when I saw that salmon hit the deck of the tanker and the chicken come back in return, I thought, well, this is really what we're doing. We're trading a wild system for a farmed system. And, you know, the question that runs throughout the book is, do we have to replace the wild system with a farm system, or could we augment it and come to some sort of peace between farmed fish and wild fish?
And I want to talk about the very positive way you think we can.
Yeah.
If we're serious about this.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
But when you look at the next couple of fish that you write about, bass and a cod.
Yeah.
It was a lesson in bass in terms of that being a farm fish that really is not a fish that should be farmed.
Yeah, I mean, it's a subtle point, but basically, so salmon were the first fish that we really went gangbusters with farming. Bass, the next fish, you know, as I said earlier, bass is this catch-all word that can apply to as many as 8 taxonomic families, you know, many, many fish. But the bass in particular that I look at is the European sea bass. And you know, because you're friends with Yoni Zohar over at the University of Maryland, that Branzino is a farmed fish. Also European sea bass, it's also called Branzino. It's also called Loup de Mer. It's also called Robalo. It's also called Bar. So take your pick. But many Americans just don't know that that's a farmed fish. I mean,
right.
That totally slipped in under the radar.
They think it's some fish you caught wild in the Mediterranean that takes up your plate.
Exactly, yes. Exactly. No, and in fact, actually, I revisited that material recently for the Times in London. They asked me to do something, and it was interesting. One of the things that got this fish in front of Northern Europeans and eventually Americans was that Greece started offering these really cheap holiday packages, and so lots of Brits and French started going down to the Mediterranean, and then they, you know, have a cheap hotel, and then they'd order the big fish. And the big fish would come grilled. You've, you know, been to a Greek restaurant, comes grilled with the lemon wedges and stuff, and it was quite often a Branzino, or, you know, also called Lavraki in Greek, which means the clever one. One of the reasons they're called the clever one is because they're so overfished, they're so hard to find that people assume that they were so clever that you couldn't catch them. Anyway, back to your question, are they a good farm fish or not? You know, the thing is, in the end, now that we've mastered them, now we've got the technology, I'd say they're sort of a mid-range fish. Their feed conversion ratio is not great. But, you know, what was true of them is that it was a huge scientific effort to tame them. You know, most fish of the bass variety, you know, called bass, they hatch out of nearly microscopic eggs. They can't take regular feed pellets when they're born. So they have to be fed these, like, you know, they had to come up with this microscopic system of enriching little tiny creatures called rotifers, and then the next step up, little tiny creatures called artemia, which actually once upon a time in America were branded as sea monkeys.
That was an interesting part of the story.
Yeah.
No idea.
Yeah. So those are sea monkeys.
And that he was a Jewish neo-Nazi, which was also yes.
Well, you know, you can't, it's not really that relevant to the fish story, but if you come across a Jewish neo-Nazi, I'm sorry, you got to put it in the, book. You know, I'm sorry. But anyway, the sea monkey thing sort of developed in parallel to its use as an aqua feed. But both of these little creatures took a huge amount of effort and also took a huge amount of effort to figure out how to spawn them in captivity. Most fish of the order Perciformes, that most fish that we eat are called bass or occupy, they don't respond well to captivity. And so you have to, you know, come up with all these strategies to figure out how to spawn them in captivity. So, yeah, if we were to look back on time, should we have invested all that money into the European sea bass to end up with this product? Maybe not. But now that we've got the technology, now that we've figured out how to spawn them, now that we've figured out the aqua feeds, there are fish out there that work with using all that technology, like, for example, the barramundi, which is in the book, a guy named Josh Goldman is farming them up in Turner's Falls, Massachusetts. And then that's a very good fish for aquaculture because, you know, it has low fish meal requirements. It takes well to crowding. It just has a life cycle like the Arctic char that fits well for aquaculture.
You have a line here when you talk about sea bass in your book. You, mm-hmm. you write, the Mediterranean is many years ahead of the rest of the world's oceans in terms of the rise of man and the fall of fish.
Yeah.
The decline of wild fish stocks in the Mediterranean in the last half century and the subsequent attempt to repopulate the sea through aquaculture is a stark forewarning of what could happen all over the world as the oceans in general become
oligotrophic.
Oligotrophic, thank you. Oligotrophic, containing little nourishment for everybody.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the Mediterranean, first of all, the Mediterranean was always a somewhat sparsely populated sea, oligotrophic, because it's all rivers, most rivers in Europe flow away from the Mediterranean. So that's one of the reasons the Mediterranean is very clear, but it means it has very few nutrients and so very few fish in it, relatively. I mean, there was a time when the Mediterranean had a lot of fish, you know, anything that we would call, a modern human would call a lot of fish. But compared to other seas, it's not as, you know, biologically productive. But, you know, the Mediterranean is ringed around by very populous countries that have fished it hard for centuries. And yes, it's giving out, you know, and it's interesting when you talk to people who work in the Mediterranean, who work in aquaculture, they don't really quite see it as a problem of sort of replacing wild fish with farmed fish. And in a way, they kind of see it as a net benefit. Huge amounts of farmed branzini, European sea bass, escape to the point where now when you often see, you'll still see wild European sea bass in the marketplace in Greece, but people I've talked to are pretty convinced that a lot of those fish are just escapees that manage to grow bigger than the farm size. So we've kind of probably, I think nobody can quite prove this, but I'm pretty sure we've shifted the genetics of the Mediterranean with these fish. And it's not just branzini. Another fish out there, which you've probably eaten, is dorade, or it's also called aurata. It looks like an American porgy, but this fish is sea bream, it's also called. This is another fish that has completely come onto our market lately, entirely farmed, and probably is deeply, deeply depressed in the Mediterranean and replaced by a farmed variant.
We'll take a short break. I'm going to come back, and when we come back from this break, I want to explore the idea of whether farm fish is more dangerous than wild fish to
yep.
eat.
Oh, sure, sure.
Get into the world of the cod.
Yep.
And talk about where we think we're going now
yep.
With this in the future, what could be our future. We want you to stay tuned for that. We're talking with Paul Greenberg. His book is The Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Fish. Stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're still here with Paul Greenberg. His book is Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food, a book that we discovered because of an article that he wrote in the New York Times Magazine about the end of tuna and inspired us to go, this is an interesting story. And we saw the book, and he's in Baltimore, so he's in our studios for this hour. So here we have this world where we're creating these fish farms. And as you point out in the book, fish farming is as old as we are as a species.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in fact, fish farming goes back 4,000 – well, maybe not as old as our species.
As species, but old in terms of our civilization.
As old as civilization. The first fish farmers, you know, go back to 4,000 years ago in China. And it's actually no coincidence that China is now the world's leader in aquaculture, producing, I think, 90% of the farmed fish in the world. The original aquaculture was actually quite sustainable and quite balanced. It was a polyculture, which consisted of silkworms on mulberry trees that overhung ponds. The casings and droppings from the silkworms would fall into the pond. Carp would eat those. They would in turn excrete into the water, which would in turn fertilize rice and other grasses, which fed ducks. So you got this sort of four or five way polyculture going that recycled waste and was actually in the end a good thing. What we've seen, you know, the last 50 years, which sometimes people call the Blue Revolution, as opposed to the Green Revolution, is the cracking of the codes of all of these very high value species that we like to eat, like salmon and tuna, and then the you know, the attempt to bring them into, you know, as I say, there are underwater mangers and make them into farm animals. Now, as we're moving forward, you know, it's, you know, we're starting to see some of the effects that aquaculture can have on wild systems. We're sort of faced with a choice. You know, do we domesticate the fish that we like as hunters that we've come to know as wild animals, or do we look for fish out there that fit the farm and that are, you know, good animals for husbandry? And I think that's sort of the key question going forward.
And it's interesting that the polyculture thing was very interesting to me, wondering whether that is a way in the future that we could actually think about how to farm fish.
Sure, and definitely. And in the book, there's, you know, I went up to the Bay of Fundy, and there's an interesting guy named Thierry Chopin who's doing a polyculture with salmon, and it's the only one I've seen so far. I think there are some other pilot. It's a pilot project, so we have to keep in mind that these are not out there full scale yet. But what he did is he's farming salmon, edible seaweeds, mussels, and sea cucumbers, and each of them absorb a different form of waste that salmon produce. And so, again, instead of one product, you're getting four, and you know, potentially instead of endlessly selectively breeding salmon and then eventually even doing transgenic work on salmon to get them to be more productive, you're creating a farm that overall is producing more tons of seafood, maybe not just salmon, but other things that, you know, contribute to the value of the farm.
So ultimately, the way you look at this in some ways is if we're going to be sustainable in how we approach fish and more and more, you know, as we know, everybody's telling us to eat more fish and eat less meat.
That's right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are examples like Chopin's example you just gave.
Yeah.
And is it Goldsmith in Massachusetts?
Goldman.
Goldman in Massachusetts. Yep. Right here in Baltimore, Yoni Zohar, and trying to do the same kind of urban fisheries idea in tanks and how to grow certain species so they're not in the water, but actually there where the fecal matter is turned and cleaned. And,
that's right, and turned into methane gas and all this
gas kind of- And trying to grow algae on the side, he's trying to do to create fuel. I mean, so these things exist.
Yeah.
And you talk about this guy, Ted Ames.
Yep.
Who I found really fascinating.
Yep.
Thinker about this.
Yeah.
We'll get to him in a second. But so there are these models that you posit with people who are really thinking about, they're not anti-fishermen, they're not anti-fisheries.
Yeah.
They're trying to figure out how to make this work, and those models are small.
Yeah.
But they may have large-scale potential.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, this is where, you know, I always say that fish are the Rodney Dangerfield of the food reform movement. They just do not get respect. And one of the reasons they don't get respect is because there are actually still a lot of them. And it's cheaper just to catch them than it is to farm them oftentimes. And it's cheaper just to catch them with abandon than to actually, you know, catch them with care and catch them in a way that doesn't damage, you know, their bottom structure and, you know, the environment that they live in. So, you know, my feeling is right now we still have the opportunity to save this wild food system that we have. And we have to figure out how to both fish better and how to farm better in a way that brings this whole thing into balance moving forward. And I think it's doable, but it's going to require some investment. And I was glad to see the Obama administration, you know, put a sort of oceans agenda on the table. But everyone I've talked to so far says it's not funded, really. You know, all these sort of bold initiatives. We got to put some money into the ocean. You know, the one woman I spoke to who's very involved with ocean conservation said that, you know, the budget of all ocean conservation stuff combined equals the price they spent on the space shuttle toilet. I don't know if that's still true, but I like to throw that one out there. But, you know, it's like, I think it's certainly not enough money by any means. You know, as an amateur statistician myself, I appreciated that.
I like that. That's very good. That's very good. One of the things, though, that struck me here is people like Ted Ames, who I mentioned a moment ago, who are really saying that, and I wrote notes all through your book.
Yep.
So are you saying to me that we should get rid of large-scale commercial fishing?
Yeah.
I kept thinking, is that what he's leading? Is that what he's going to take us to? And Ted Ames is saying that we can still have our fish and do it in a different way without that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, Ted and what Ted is imagining. So Ted, just to introduce him, he is a MacArthur Genius grantee. He's a former cod fisherman. And he sort of came ashore, as they say in Maine, stopped fishing and tried to sort of look at the whole problem. Why did Maine's fisheries go bust? Why did we lose so much cod? What is the future going forward? And what he imagines is, you know, really trying to get away from these sort of super trawlers and this huge, huge sort of megalithic, politically armed fishing industry that has the ability to kind of bend regulation, to fish really hard, and try and look at this more as an artisanal activity where, again, you have to sort of reimagine the product too, where codfish is no longer seen as something that you put in a fish stick or in a filet of fish sandwich, that this is a
Which is what happened to the cod in some ways.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, the bird's eye probably has more had more overall effect on cod stocks than anyone else because the invention of frozen food and, you know, the ability to process fish sticks and all these kinds of things turned this wild animal into and turn the Grand Banks essentially into a factory.
The Grand Banks, the place off the coast of Maine, where
off of Canada.
Canada.
Yeah. Right. And the Grand Banks and this Grand Banks, there's George's Bank, two big codfish grounds, but basically turn those into a factory for producing product for a factory that turns it into mashed up stuff that gets re-rendered as fish sticks. So it's that industrialization of these wild animals that I think long-term is not sustainable. Now, the alternative that's being thrown up a lot of times so Ted would like to see this sort of array of small-scale fishermen who are using hook and line, not trawling the bottom. You know, trawling the bottom pretty much can destroy all the bottom fauna and which in turn, you know, causes a negative spiral. But what he imagines, you know, small-scale fleet, hook and line fishermen getting more dollars per pound for their catch. So they don't have to use these industrial methods to bring in so many fish. They're bringing in fish that, you know, are caught fresh, sold fresh, you know, that are valued on the plate instead of, you know, rendered as this just fish mash. The alternative to that, so that's one approach, and I tend towards his prescriptions. The other approach that's going on right now is actually happening in Alaska. And actually, you know, the next fisheries crisis, I really believe, is Alaska.
The pollock.
The pollock, but also all of Alaska. All of our salmon comes from Alaska, but all of our pollock. So pollock is this thing. Have you ever seen an Alaska pollock in a fish market?
I can't recall the same one.
I don't think anyone has. And the reason is because that's Alaska is now our whitefish fish factory. 3 billion pounds of Alaska pollock is harvested yearly. Fish sticks, filet fish sandwiches, also actually used to make fake crab. Crab with a K. anyway, so those fish are being hit pretty hard, but you know they're also certified by the Marine Stewardship Council. There's all sorts of arguments why that's a very large scale fishery, but there's a lot of arguments that it's very controlled and that it should be fine. The stock is going down, you know, but some people say that's just a fluctuation, that they're tooling accordingly. But, you know, it's interesting. I asked Ted Ames, you know, what he thought of it. And he said, you know, an old friend of mine had a good way of summing this up. He's never get between a fat hog and a trough. He'll run you over every time.
I love that line.
He'll run you over every time. And the thing is, that's the thing. You know, the pollock industry is huge. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of money concentrated into few hands. It's not like it's like a corrupt system, but it's just that they have the muscle to argue in favor of their vision of regulation. And, you know, there are people out there. Greenpeace, for example, very adamantly feels that the pollock industry, you know, is really causing some serious damage. 120,000 king salmon were caught in 2000, I think, seven or eight, as bycatch, which means they get dumped overboard. And that actually is more salmon than, I think the amount of salmon that was coming from the Yukon River that was caught as bycatch was larger than what was the legal catch of salmon on the Yukon that year. So, you know, you got to look at these damages that are occurring, and you have to start thinking about if we need an industrial product, is fishing necessarily the best way to get there?
So, but something is, and one of the things you talk about, I mean, let me just step back a second. Mm-hmm. I'm going to come back to this fish that you talk about towards the end of the book.
Yep.
The tilapia and the fish that you talk about.
Yep.
But also just to get a sense of the cod, because we've interviewed Michael Kurlansky on the show here
Mark,
before.
Mark,
the book he did on called Cod.
That, yep.
And your book is not Cod. It's a very different book. It takes us actually from that moment in the sense of where we're going.
That's right. I mean, if you want to talk about inspirations, Mark Kurlansky's Cod was really the thing that sent me on this quest. And I did want to consciously pick up where Mark left off and take us forward.
It was a great book. And he's a great writer and thinker.
Yep, indeed.
But to talk about the cod, I mean, because one of the things you talk about, what I found very interesting, is that it wasn't just the overfishing of cod.
Mm-hmm.
It was the killing off of what the cod ate.
Exactly. Yes. And that's very, very important. Actually, you know, of course, you know, no writer likes it when another writer goes back and revisits some of his sources. But I did, you know, on Mark's advice, I talked to some of the people that Mark had talked to. And one guy named George Rose spoke about the collapse of capelin, which is a herring-like fish that cod eat, as a precursor to the really big cod declines. And that might be climate change related, but it's also those capelin have increasingly been fished themselves to be used for salmon feed. So there's been a huge depletion of those. The other big thing, though, which Ted talks about and which has been fascinating to me, I noticed that we're talking here at the Mill Center, right? And it's probably Mill Center because we're near that river over there. Probably once upon a time there was a small-scale dam on the river just adjacent
here. Oh,
there
was. And this is a place where they made all kinds of fabric, and that's why this is the Mill Center.
That's right. And so these little dams are actually all over the East Coast and the West Coast as well. And these small-scale dams, what they're doing is they're in effect, they're like blocking the transfer of energy from the sun to fish. Because, you know, once upon a time, all these little rivers up and down the East Coast supported runs of herring, alewives, all these kind of creatures that would head upstream just like salmon, spawn in the rivers, and then migrate out. One time, river herring were as populous as passenger pigeons. Now it's illegal to fish for the single hook and line for them in Massachusetts. You know, it's a huge, huge loss of biomass. So, you know, cod in Maine were documented. One of the things that Ted Ames did is he interviewed old timer fishermen and tried to establish where had the cod runs been. And he had talked to 90-year-old fishermen who remember cod swimming up into the mouths of rivers. Now, you know, for me, I'm a fisherman. When I want to go cod fishing, I have to go 2 hours offshore. That cod were present in the mouth of rivers. And what were they chasing? They were chasing herring. So when those herring runs ended, those cod runs ended as well. So actually a huge potential for rebuilding our coastal fisheries is to get rid of these little dams, which we don't need anymore. We don't have textile mills that are powered by these little mills anymore. And there's in the state of Connecticut alone, there are 3,000 to 6,000 mill dams. And, you know, that's a no-brainer in my mind. Let's take some of this so-called Ocean Initiative money, remove these dams. That don't do anything anyway right now, and we'll energize the system. We'll put more little fish in the sea, which will mean more bigger fish eventually.
You also write about how if we stopped fishing for a period of time since some places are limited,
yep,
how the oceans and the waters can really rejuvenate themselves and the fish, and it's been proven that happens.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, people, you know, fishermen always argue, they say, oh, pollution, habitat destruction, whatever, that's what's really causing this problem. But then they continue to fish. And undoubtedly, environmental problems, you know, like pollution and so forth, are factors. But, like, let's look at, here we are in Maryland. Let's look at the rockfish or the American striped bass.
Right.
You know, this is a fish that was down to less than 5 million animals in 1982. But, you know, you probably lived through this period here where you were in Baltimore at the time.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So, you know, so they actually closed down the fishery in Maryland, parts of Virginia. They, you know, huge, huge commercial restrictions. And now we're at a point where we have somewhere in the order of 55 million striped bass or rockfish out there. And it's been as high as 70 million. So we laid off those fish. We protected a couple of really important what are called year classes of fish so that they could grow, spawn. They came back. And even with codfish, the Gulf of Maine stock of codfish is now considered 50% rebuilt. It was at 12% about 10 years ago. And it is actually rebuilding and gaining ground.
Because we're not fishing it commercially.
You know, it's still being fished commercially, but nowhere near as hard. And you know, whether the rebuilding targets that the Marine Fisheries Service has set is what we should be rebuilding towards, that's debatable. But what's not debatable is that we're gaining ground on some fish. And so the idea of shutting down fisheries and actually keeping some of our coast fishing free and sort of creating sort of the equivalent of like the National Forest Service for fish, where you have marine protected areas scattered throughout the country to protect key spawning grounds, that these can be like, they don't have to be sort of touchy-feely environmental conservation things. It's like putting money in the bank account. You save, you protect your spawning stock, you're going to have more fish, commercial fish down the road.
Let's talk a minute about, though, and it's not talking about the fish, but it is.
Yep.
Which is, again, Ted Ames and others in your book.
Yeah.
Because he was a fisherman. Talk about including the people who were involved in fishing.
In
the process.
Yeah.
Of what to do. Pardon me, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
And so this is an important piece, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, what Ted feels is that you shouldn't be allowed in the wheelhouse of a boat unless you've passed an exam in marine ecology. And I think that is a very important point. You know, it's not, the education level of fishermen varies from where you go. And out in the West Coast, certainly have actually a very high sensitivity to this. But also, if you notice in the West Coast, in California, they've established more marine protected areas than anywhere else. And so I think it goes hand in hand. If fishermen understand the point of marine protected areas, that these aren't just sort of, you know, PETA people trying to call, you know, protect the sea kittens, but that, no, that's actually an important management tool. Because what marine protected areas do is actually, they do the only thing, they do the most important thing that only a marine protected area can do. They protect the biggest fish. You know, because if there's no fishing, if there's fishing present, people will catch the biggest fish. If there's no present fishing present, the biggest fish are protected. And it's really the big, huge fish that are the ecological drivers of reproduction. So if we can keep some fish big and spawning, then you do a lot. You know, it varies from species to species, of course. So anyway, so going back to Ted's model, we got to educate fishermen, and we have to see them, they have to see themselves as kind of stewards as well as fishermen, that, you know, it's, the analogy I throw out there is herders, that they need to see their fish as a flock. Right. And, you know, with fish, the phrase, so many fish in the sea, is a dangerous one, because the tendency has been is that when one stock goes down, you move to another, which works as long as there are not too many fishermen out there. Then it becomes like a crop rotation. But when there's too many fishermen out there, you know, the other stocks never get a chance to recover. And so I think fishermen need to know what are the warning signs in the ecosystem that show overfishing is present and needs to stop. You know, there's not enough regulators out there, so fishermen need to actually have the ecological knowledge to be self-regulators to some degree.
I mean, one of the things when you talk about this in the beginning of the book, you write about Robert Blackwell and like begets like in terms of fish farming.
Yeah.
And that, he wasn't about fish farming, he was talking about animal husbandry.
But, right.
And I think that, I mean, the roots of the problem are there, and it's kind of changing a mindset and a way of doing things.
Yep.
Because as you said, fish farming is not going anywhere, and fishermen want to survive.
Yep, yep. Well, and in fact, you know, fish farming is now represent, you know, seafood farming now represents 50% of the marketplace, practically. So
I mean, in terms of the fish.
In terms of raw weight, you know, half of our fish and shellfish are farmed pretty
and growing.
Much. And growing. And it's the fastest growing form of food production in the world. So aquaculture is not going anywhere. But I guess going forward, you know, if we're going to make our fishermen into these sort of careful stewards who are not going to take so many fish, who are going to be more cautious in their methods and so forth, it's going to result in less wild fish harvested. And so we're going to end up with less fish in the markets. This is a point where aquaculture can play a role, but we can't choose aquaculture species that require, you know, many pounds of fish feed to grow a single pound of fish. We can't do fish farms in sensitive coastal areas where disease transfer to wild fish causes a net loss of fish.
You know, so where can we go? Talk about these fish you were talking about in your book that where we might be able to go that we've that are in Asia and in other places that we could.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's important to first of all, you have to remember the marketplace and what's out there. And one of the reasons I chose these four fish is that they represented these sort of archetypes of flesh. You know, we always want to see, we open the page of a seafood menu, we want to see something white and flaky that we can fry codfish. We want to see something white and meaty that we can broil sea bass.
Sea bass.
You want to see a pink succulent salmon, and then finally sort of red and steaky or steaky. You know, that's where you got your tuna. So I think these archetypes are implanted in the minds of humans at this point. So we have to figure out, well, what can we work with each archetype? With cod, if we're looking for a white flaky thing, tilapia, a fish from Africa that is really good on the farm, that grows to maturity in about 8 months versus farming cod, for example, takes 2 or 3 years to get a mature cod. You can grow a mature tilapia in 8 months. You know, a tilapia can be fed on pretty much vegetarian feed. And this is true of a bunch of other fish out there. There's a fish called the traw from Vietnam, which
I
mentioned, which actually is interesting. You know, the traw actually can breathe air. So you can stock them in very, very high densities. And if they get a little oxygen thirsty, they just reach their mouths above the water and breathe some air. So they're kind of icky looking fish, but the flesh is the same old white flesh that you can do in your standard cookery. It's actually recently appeared on the marketplace as swai. Have you seen that in
no,
the marketplace?
I have not seen that, no.
Now that I've told you, it's going to be like sort of like in Repo Man, plate of shrimp, plate of shrimp. You're going to see it everywhere. But swai is now, swai is actually a compromise with the American catfish farmers, growers. They don't want this fish being marketed as catfish because they have their own species of catfish.
But it's the same family.
It's the same order. I think right. It's Silura formes is the order. So it's the same order, but it's sort of like calling it catfish is like be calling every piece of meat we eat hoofed mammal. You know, so I'll have 2 pounds of hoofed mammal, please. Which one do you want? Do you want a lamb? Nah, I'll take the beef hoofed mammal. So that's sort of what we do. And anyway, that's what that's the stink the catfish farmers had. So now it's called swai in the marketplace. So there's these fish out there that actually work pretty well in an industrial setting, and those might be the fish that we use for our fish sticks. Actually, I was in a Denny's recently, and the only fish on the menu was tilapia, curiously enough, which, you know, is a testament to its cheapness, which, you know, frankly, maybe that's what the market needs. So, but fish, you know, fish are valuable, and we should never treat them. I mean, wild fish, I mean. And it's treating them as cheap industrial product that I think is where all the problem comes from, ultimately.
It's a fascinating way of kind of opening a discussion that I think that the kind of work you do is important because it kind of raises this dialogue and conversation in a way that isn't being raised anywhere else.
Well, you know, there certainly are great fish books out there. You know, there's a good book called The End of the Line by a guy named Charles Clover.
Oh, yes, right.
You know, and, you know, my inspiration in all this is a guy named Carl Safina, who wrote a fantastic book called Song for the Blue Ocean. But those books have tended, I think, to look at fish as, well, rightly, as a wildlife issue, but which is fine. But what happens with those books is, like, the same people that are interested in ecology and so forth read them and then get themselves hyped up but then have nowhere to talk about this in a larger context. For me, the way I tried to approach this was that it's a food issue and that the oceans are food systems. And you know, they're not just places to mine oil and minerals and do all sorts of bad things, that we need to start reimagining our coasts as, you know, as these places we eat from. And I think once we understand that we're eating from these coasts, that we'll start to value them more. Because, you know, we're in the era of the foodie right now. And let the era of the foodie wash out of the land and into the sea. And you know, may 1,000 you know, sustainable fisheries come forth and multiply.
I love that idea. The tune as you end up is about maintaining wildlife.
Yes.
It's about an animal that is so magnificent,
yeah,
so huge, and perhaps so smart.
Yeah, well, at least extremely agile, let's say.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, so, yeah, the last chapter of the book is very much about sort of reimagining fish as wildlife. And, you know, I take as the example the bluefin tuna, which, you know, a lot of people don't realize is warm-blooded. It's not a mammal, but it, you know, it has a unique form of endothermia where it can raise its ambient temperature 20 degrees warmer than the ocean, which enables it to hunt in very, very broad ranges. And the bluefin actually crosses the ocean. It spawns in the Gulf of Mexico, and the other stock spawns in the Mediterranean. They crisscross the breadth of the Atlantic. And in the Pacific, they crisscross the Pacific. You know, swimming up to 40 miles an hour. So if this were on four legs and running around at 40 miles an hour and, you know, as magnificent looking at, most people never actually get a chance to see a whole tuna or a live tuna. And they are incredible when they come out of the water.
Huge.
You know, huge. And just also, you know, we've all probably seen a picture of a bluefin strung up on a dock, you know, or frozen at the Tsukiji market in Japan. But when a tuna first comes out of the water, it is miraculous. Like, there's this tuna, and a lot of the pelagic deep sea fish do this thing they call lighting up when they go hunt. And it's like a phosphorus iridescence that lights up their back and the sides. And when you catch them, and I've caught them, and bring them in. I haven't actually killed a bluefin, but I've killed yellowfin. When they come in the boat, you know, their fins are glowing and whatever. And it's almost like, you know, nobody ever gets to see that moment. And if they did, I don't think they'd ever look at a piece of sushi the same way again.
I haven't because of you.
Sorry about that. Sorry, Mark.
But this has been a great lesson. It's a great book. And I really am glad you wrote it. And I'm glad we waited until we got the book and didn't just do the article.
I'm glad, too, because it's you know, the tuna is just one piece of a very complex matrix.
So we've been talking with Paul Greenberg. The book is For Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food, Penguin Press. Really a well-written, easy, fast read, chock full of stuff. Thank you, Paul.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Good to have you here. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.